the nations around the world that have the most sort of gender equal societies, nobody handed it to women. They fought for it themselves and they demanded it. And in Iceland in the 1970s, the women shut down the country in order for over abortion rights. And, you know, the ultimately we are going to have to mobilize. We don't all agree. We're not going to all agree. We never will. We're as diverse as the nation, but there are some core issues that we need to stand up and fight for.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
I'm Lauren Leder, founder and CEO of All In Together. And I'm obsessed with telling women stories and giving them the voice that they, ensuring they get the voice they deserve. And welcome to Sylvia and Me.
Thank you so much for joining me today. You know, we were talking a few minutes ago. I had seen you on your commentator, frequent commentator on a number of shows. One happens to be on MSNBC, Morning Joe.
Morning Joe.
And what you were talking about really grabbed me. And therefore, I wanted to not only meet you, but get what you do out there. And you're a widely respected thought leader on diversity and women's issues in the workplace, politics, and as you say, in between. You're also the author of Crossing the Thinnest Line, How Embracing Diversity from the Office to the Oscars Makes America Stronger. You talk about All In Together, and that was founded in 2014. And as it says, it's one of the only nonprofit, nonpartisan organizations training a generation of American women across the economic and political divide on civics and civic leaders. And since its founding, it's trained nearly 10,000 women and reached millions. I love the mission statement that you have on there. All In Together encourages, equips, educates, and empowers voting age women to participate fully in America's civic and political life. Okay. Yeah. So now we have a lot of your background. What made you feel that there was such a strong need to advocate for women? Was there any specific incident that happened that you went, you know, wow, we're really not, you know, we need a stronger voice?
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, there's so many. I say, you know, anger is often an important motivator. And I think it was for me. I had a corporate career earlier in my 20s and 30s, and just got increasingly angry that I felt that at how I saw women being treated in the workplace. But then also what really got me into politics, aside from the fact that I in fairness, I grew up in Washington, D.C. I grew up in politics. So I was surrounded by politics. My mother worked for Bella Abzug the year I was born. She was deeply involved in all of the, you know, most important work of the women's movement in the 1970s. So it was definitely like in the blood and in the water, if you will. But I didn't think it was really something I cared about it. I didn't think it was what I would spend my career doing. And when I started facing, you know, just really ridiculous situations in the workplace, I mean, for me, the thing that really angered me and got me off the sidelines was paid leave issues, because I was working for companies. You know, the United States is the only nation in the world, in the developed world, that does not have statutory paid leave. And I was asked to sort of figure out a paid leave policy when I was working for a startup. And, you know, they wanted to pay the secretary for 2 weeks and the senior woman for 8 weeks. And just the whole thing made me insane. And then we had a whole argument about why they should pay it at all. And it really made me mad. And because of my childhood in Washington, I happened to know the person who had written the Family Medical Leave Act. It was the mother of one of my childhood friends. Her name is Judy Lichtman. She's still a big activist on those issues. She runs the National Partnership for Women and Families in Washington. And so I called her and I said, what can I do? And she said, well, come to Washington. You can help us walk the halls of Congress. and harangue members of Congress about it. So for me, that was a real wake up. And, you know, I think also the motivation for starting All In Together was really the sort of late Obama years as we were looking at this pending election. We knew Hillary Clinton was going to run. And you could feel that I was working with a lot of women's groups around the country, and you could feel this sort of simmering rage. Lean In had come out. We were all being told that the answer was just to try harder. And I think a lot of women were looking around and saying, wait a minute, you know, something's missing here. The system seems to be broken. But the thing that was missing, Sylvia, was that they did not, so many of the women that I spoke to did not see political participation as a solution. They weren't making the connect. So they would, you know, they'd get involved on women's advocacy stuff at work. But as soon as you said politics, they were like, I'm out. And that seemed like a real problem to me.
Well, it definitely is. You know, the stats are, and what's believed and is true is a man will go ahead and if he's asked to run or thinks about it, he won't think twice. A woman will look in the mirror and start questioning, is she good enough? Can she do this? Does she have the time to do this? You know, who's going to vote for her? How, you know, so.
I mean, often they won't even consider it. I mean, well, the political ambition of women has declined. And I think that there's new data out showing that despite the fact that we do now have record numbers of women serving in public office, although it's good to gut check that because that record number still isn't even 30%. And in the current 2022 cycle, according to the Center for American Women in Politics that tracks these numbers, it's still only about 16% of all candidates are female. And most women won't even consider it. I mean, it's just absolutely beyond the pale of anything that they think is relevant for their lives. And then even those who do consider it, obviously the barriers are very significant and they remain high, you know, the sort of public scrutiny and, you know, all of the things. And it takes an enormous amount of self-confidence and courage for women, to your point. And they do often have to be recruited and asked, and they're often not recruited and asked. They're not always the most obvious people, although that's been changing. But, you know, I should say one thing you didn't mention in my bio, I am an elected official. I ran for local office in my town in Westchester County, New York, and I won in 2019. I was the only woman on the board for the first 2 years. Now I'm the only Democrat, but there's two more women. So like, we'll give them, you know, that's progress. You know, when I talk to women in my town, you know, they always say, well, I'm not like you. I couldn't do what you do. You know, they maybe will weigh into the most divisive politics on the PTA and the school board stuff that they seem very comfortable with. And I'll tell you, it can be way worse than,
well,
than,
we've
than
seen
politics
that
it, at large.
Right. We've seen that it's way worse in so many horrific ways.
It
which,
can be.
You know, for some women, they'll dig their heels in, finally. Because of what is going on. And so that will make a woman really stand her ground. But as you said, women, we thought, because Congress, with all the new women and the younger women that had come in, that we really had broken the barrier, which is not true.
It's not true. And unfortunately, what I was starting to say is that this example of these amazing women, and obviously like from the vice presidency on down, you know, Nancy Pelosi and Kamala Harris in the second and third most powerful political roles in our nation. And yet it's not translating to an increase in ambition, political ambition among women. And that I think is really a problem. So, you know, a huge part of what we do at All In Together, we're not, our mission is not necessarily around getting women to run for office. We're trying to get women to be interested even in politics at all, and to see political participation as a tool for making a difference. And, you know, that's has ebbed and flowed in terms of how hard of a sell that is. But, you know, women outvote men. We've outvoted men in every election since 1980. And so we understand the responsibility of our civic duty. We show up and we vote. Black women, especially, who are the most likely to be registered to vote and show up to the polls and, you know, truly are the keepers of democracy in so many ways in this country. But beyond that, you know, that is where it often stops. You know, we're willing to vote, but we're not willing to engage, and we're not willing to hold leaders accountable, and we're not willing to tell them what we care about and what we want them to do. And so all of those things, and then, of course, if you don't see political participation as a way to make things better, you're much less likely to then ever think about running. And so we're trying to deal with sort of the core problem, which is how do we help women see that politics is actually can be positive and constructive? Yes, even now. And that it is a path to personal power and to, you know, advancing important issues for your family and for the people around you. And I think, you know, women want to do good. They want to make sure that, you know, they want to speak up on behalf of their communities. They put others before themselves so often. But we need to show them that politics can be a way to do that. Because if they don't and they continue to opt out, we're going to continue to wind up with outcomes that are not representing their interests.
Well, that's the thing. And it really starts at the local level, not necessarily at the highest, office that you could hold, right? Because if we don't start it at the local level, we won't really be affecting change, as we've seen, you know, what's going on in so many states where, yeah, as women, our rights that we were so proud of getting are being chipped away.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I've been speaking more about, and actually was the week before you saw me on Morning Joe, I was talking about this on Morning Joe, and that is that there's really growing evidence that the rollback of women's rights is very directly tied to the rollback of democracy, that they're linked, that, and that's not just here in the United States, it's actually all over the world. And in fact, I think that we missed some critical signs. Look, there are a lot of things we missed about Putin, but his assault on women's rights is actually part of the picture, the larger picture of the rise of his autocracy. Right? There are 450 jobs in Russia that are now prohibited for women. He has, you know, rolled back protections for survivors of domestic violence, rolled back women's political participation. There were only 16% women in the Russian parliament, compared to, by the way, in the Ukraine, where there's been 22% women in the parliament and where you've seen women entering the military. And so right around the world, this participation of women and women's rights is directly tied to democracy, right? And where you've seen the participation of women in democratic movements, they've been more successful. And I've been talking more and more about the Arab Spring, which we sort of has faded somewhat from public consciousness, but it's a really good example, because the one country that came through the Arab Spring with, you know, really a fairly stable democracy is Tunisia. And it's not an accident, because in Tunisia, women's rights and women's participation in the Arab Spring was critical. And in fact, their constitution now guarantees proportional representation of women in their parliament. So, you know, and you look then at the other end of the spectrum, which is in Saudi and in other parts of the world where women's rights are so diminished. Those are also places that have, you know, strong-armed autocracy. So, like, we need to start understanding these links better. And it's not some faraway place. It's happening here.
It's happening here. We see in the last couple of years where there have been laws that are being passed that just keep dwindling women's rights. And what do you think is the biggest thing that we can do about that? I mean, you know, between voting rights and the abortion bill and how do we take the importance of democracy and really get it out there so that women understand that we need to act now before we lose it all?
Yeah. And I think, look, I mean, I think there's some signs that particularly the rollback of abortion rights is very galvanizing for women. And, you know, we'll see our poll. We did some polling just a month or so ago, and you know, really that I believe Roe v. Wade will be overturned this spring. And I also believe that it will be, a massive rallying point for women in terms of their participation in the upcoming election. On the other hand, there's a lot of fatigue and a lot of sort of apathy out there, the sense that it's also broken and we're also exhausted, that there's nothing that can be done. And I think that's what worries me, is that we need, you know, the opposite is we need the opposite to happen. We need, you know, we need to really have significant mass movements and political participation of women. And it's most urgent when you start seeing the rollbacks of rights. So look, you mentioned local politics. One of the reasons why we are where we are, and I hate to be very, you know, this blunt, it's honestly because Democrats particularly have been asleep at the switch when it came to state legislatures. And we've been asleep at the switch for more than 20 years. You know, it started in the late 80s, early 90s, when, you know, the Republican National Committee, and all the way through, you know, sort of 10, 15 years forward, focused intensely on getting conservatives elected to state legislatures and to school boards across the country in places like Texas and Florida and elsewhere. And they have built, to their credit, an unbelievable machine that has enabled really what is ultimately not especially representative in those states. I mean, Texas, you could argue, really is still a majority Republican state, but the legislature has such a hugely outsized Republican representation. And that's absolutely true in Florida, which is a much more purple state, but has, you know, an overwhelmingly Republican majority. But shame on the Democrats for having completely not paid attention to this for decades, and frankly, not focused money or resources on local or state races, not focused resources and attention on gerrymandering really until the last few years, which has enabled really an ultimately undemocratic set of representations in a whole bunch of states. So look, there are ultimately, you know, politics is a lifetime of work. It's a marathon, not a sprint. You know, members of Congress will often say to me, you know, in politics, you learn to relish the incremental. And I think that's hard for a lot of Americans to get their head around, like that the small victories are still victories. But we have to be willing to play the long game. And, you know, abortion rights opponents have played an unbelievably effective long game, you know, for 40 years.
Unfortunately, they have. So how can we?
And they have been relentless in their political engagement. And yes, they have been relentless in holding the leaders that they elect accountable for standing by the issues that they voted for them on. And that has been, you know, a pro-life agenda. You know, the pro-choice movement has not been nearly as well as intensely focused. In some circles, yes. But if you look at the ways in which Republican politics has been so totally centered on the rollback of abortion rights for 40 years, right? And in some ways, it's easier to fight, you know, something you're trying to oppose than it is to fight for something that you're trying to protect. And I think there's sort of a psychological piece to that. But, you know, that ultimately is why we are where we are, you know, from the Supreme Court on down. I mean, this is 40 years of strategy and relentless focus on the part of opponents, and they're winning. And I think ultimately, abortion rights supporters we're gonna need to figure out how to mobilize in a much bigger way at the state and local level, and frankly, to hold leaders accountable. And there's a very interesting bellwether race around this issue in Texas right now, which is the Jessica Cisneros race against Henry Kuller, who's the last remaining pro-life Democrat in the House of Representatives. And that race has gone to a runoff. She has been endorsed by Bernie and a whole bunch of, you know, progressive folks. But ultimately, like, that's a race that in some ways I think is really representative of what's happening right now, is that, you know, she's stood up to say, wait a minute, how can you be a Democrat and be an opponent of abortion rights? And she's been trying to take him down. It's her second cycle, and we'll see if she wins.
So, you know, what you're talking about is very bleak. How do we turn it around? I mean, seriously, and right now, looking at the way things are going, it's bleak. Between book banning, abortion rights being taken away, voting rights being taken away, you know, making it harder and harder for women to have any control, not only over their own bodies, but a choice and you know, some of the voting rights that are being taken away are making it harder and harder for women to who have children to be able to get to the voting polls, to, you know, the time, you know, most of these women are working women. The pandemic, you know, did things that, you know, just destroyed a lot of what women were just making some inroads in doing. How do we turn this around? I know it's going to take time, but we don't really have a lot of time.
Well, a lot for of sure. I think that's fair. Although I will say this, my favorite quote lately is Bishop Desmond Tutu, who said famously that he is a prisoner of hope. And that's how I feel. You know, I'm not despondent about this. Look, I think ultimately there's a few things that I think are really encouraging. We went through on last year, January 6th, one of the most sort of threatening moments since the existence of our democracy. And we survived. We survived. Our election was not overturned. Good people who believe in the core values of our nation, which is representative democracy, stood up and fought back. And we have strong and stable institutions, ultimately, that protect a lot of the rights that we all believe are so fundamental to democracy. And I think we overlook that, and it is a bleak time in some ways. On the other hand, I believe in the redemptive possibilities of political participation. And, you know, Donald Trump was not reelected. And it's not just about a party or politics. Ultimately, we have forces in this country that, you know, do stand up for the rights of those who are oppressed. One thing that's, I think, really interesting about the abortion piece, I was just reading this before I got on with you. Citi, the financial services institution, is going to be paying the cost for women who have to travel out of state to get abortions. You're seeing lots and lots of businesses stand up around protecting abortion rights. We've seen very similar things around the LGBTQ issues, right? Where before gay marriage was passed, there were endless attempts to roll back gay rights. We've actually seen tremendous progress on that front, despite the horrific efforts to go after trans kids, which I think are appalling. The fact is, we have constitutional protection for gay rights, constitutional protection for the, you know, employment rights of gays and lesbians. There is a lot to work from, and nothing in politics is forever. Our system was built in order to be responsive to the will of the people. It's how it was constructed by the founders. And so ultimately, you know, we have the power to change these things. And I do think that the growing activism and engagement of younger voters is an extraordinarily hopeful sign. You know, they came out in the 2020 election in historic numbers. Okay. They absolutely are unwilling to stand by the status quo. They've been willing to, you know, push on issues that matter to them. And that includes climate change and abortion rights and diversity issues, all of those things. So I think that part of what we're seeing is, you know, this massive culture backlash against progress that's coming from, you know, those on the far right who have been empowered, but it is not representative of the majority of Americans. The majority of Americans support a woman's right to choose by not even a close number. It's like 80%, it's not even close. The majority of Americans, you know, believe that children should be have access to read books that might make them uncomfortable because they're going to learn something. You know, the majority of Americans believe that, you know, believe in gender equity and racial equity and LGBTQIA equity. The majority of Americans think those things are part of what it is to be American. And sometimes it takes the threat, and look, I'm going to tie it to the Ukraine for a minute because it is the most salient issue of our time. There is nothing like the threat of losing what you hold dear to make you appreciate and value how essential it is to fight for it. And that is human nature. And in some ways, I think maybe this year, I hope it will be. I think the Trump years were a wake up for many Americans. I think that if Roe is overturned, it will be the wake up call I think, for many Americans about how important it is to fight to protect the things that we believe in. And I say we because it is the majority. It is the majority. And ultimately, I believe in our system, flawed as it is. I still think that we have endless potential to shape this nation in alignment with the core values on which it was founded.
Well, the other thing, you know, one of the things, and believe me, I am as hopeful as you are. I do not go by the bleakness, because one of the things to me is, as you said, all the young people who came out in throes of, you know, just coming and voting, and they don't know what it was like before. So many people now, just as far as LGBTQ rights, abortion rights, it's what they grew up with. Mm-hmm. You know, it's what they grew up with. So therefore, they don't know any different. And really, it's a wake up call to see that there had to be a fight for these rights to be where they are now, and to have them taken away, something that they're used to having. Yeah. You know, it's the same thing that goes on with like women in Afghanistan. Most of them always, they knew they could get an education, they could do so much, and now all of that's been shut down. Same thing in Russia. You mentioned Ukraine and why, you know, what caught my eye. And you talked about Ukraine's secret weapon. Tell us what that is.
Well, look, I think a lot of us have seen the images of women on the front lines of the battle for the sovereignty of Ukraine, and were moved by it. There was this particular picture on the cover of the New York Times of a woman sort of weeping, holding a Kalashnikov as she was heading for the front lines, that for me just was so, you know, personal. And I started really looking at what was happening, and it's fascinating. I mean, look, the numbers of women already, the Ukraine before the current conflict had very high numbers of women in the armed forces. In fact, starting in 2014, when the Russians, with the first Russian incursion, it triggered a whole wave of women joining the armed services. And then in 2018, which I think is so interesting, not only did they join, then they fought for their own rights to have equal access to equal roles on the battlefield. They fought for the right to be on the front lines and to be treated as full equals in the Ukrainian military. And they won that right in 2018. And so even more women joined the military after that. It was the women themselves who fought for that within the Ukraine. And then in this current conflict, you know, you're seeing just extraordinary examples of women, not just, you know, picking up arms, women from the parliament to Miss Ukraine, who herself joined the military rather than leave the country. But then also we're hearing stories of women who have taken their children to safety across the border and gotten on trains and returned in order to fight alongside their countrymen. And it's just an extraordinary testament to the power of women and why we matter in every environment. But the other thing I've been pointing out is that some of the sort of psychological ways in which women have undermined Russian psyche and the Russian military is really incredible. And we've heard the stories of, you know, women confronting Russian soldiers and giving them food and tea and handing them their phone and asking them to call their mothers in Russia. And the mothers asking them, why are you there? Come home, surrender. And on the surface, that seems like a really sort of soft thing to do. On the other hand, national security advisors will say that actually that kind of psychological warfare is enormously powerful in undermining the unity and the strength and the will to fight of the Russian military. And I think when we look back on, you know, ultimately, none of us know where this is going. This is an absolutely horrific chapter in world history. You know, millions of people are suffering. We all feel for them. But I think it's so important to look at the ways in which, you know, those Ukrainian women, the fact that, you know, that the Ukrainian democracy includes women fully, and that they're treated the way they are, and that the Ukrainian ambassador to the United States is a woman, that the first lady of Ukraine has been such a critical part of the global appeal. Like, this stuff matters, and it's part of what you're fighting for, right? When we talk about fighting for democracy, that's what it means. It means fighting for the rights of all your citizens to be full and equal participants in your in that society. And so for me, you know, it's emblematic of, you know, what the Ukraine stands for, of what this battle stands for. And, you know, we should all be remembering these amazing women.
So how do we transfer women like that in Ukraine to where we are now in America? How do we get women to really accept and be able to look at themselves? And if someone hasn't, you know, said, why don't you run for office? They themselves say, you know what? I don't like what's going on. I have a voice. I'm going to do that. How do we get things to move in that direction?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. And I think a lot of us are experimenting and trying to figure that out and have been for a really long time. And, you know, we've certainly seen some amazing successes. I think there's a couple of things. I think some of it is money. You know, we have to have more money that flows to supporting the pipeline of women who could run for office, who should run for office. It's still challenging for them. And when I say money, it's not just about funding them. It's in their campaigns. It's really about funding the infrastructure that it takes to support women's political ambition writ large. There's a lot of money at the federal level, so groups like Emily's List, et cetera, but there's not as much resources for women at the local level. You know, when I ran for local office, I think I got money from some unions. I was able to get some money from a great PAC called Vote Mama, which I'm a huge fan of, but it's nothing like what happens at the federal level. So we've got to figure out how to support women at the local level. We have to give more resources to, you know, local activists and community groups that are trying to foster women's political participation beyond running for office, so that there's a bigger ecosystem of women's political engagement. And people, as I say, that people see more what it feels like and have positive experiences, et cetera. And I think we have to just keep talking about it. And frankly, we need the men to play a bigger role in this. You know, we need male elected leaders at the state, local, and federal level to be cultivating proteges among the women in their lives, to be encouraging women to step forward, supporting them in doing it. We cannot just do this alone. But ultimately, you know, look, when you look around the world, and maybe this is sort of a good place to bring it all together, but when you look around the world at the places where there are at the most gender equal societies, and the World Economic Forum puts out this great list every year that ranks the most gender equal countries in the world. And it's usually Iceland at the top of the list, and then the Nordic countries. We were 37th in the world this year, which is actually a big improvement.
Because we were like 98 back in 2019.
Indeed. So it's a step up, but still not great. So, I mean, look, the nations around the world that have the most sort of gender equal societies, nobody handed it to women. They fought for it themselves and they demanded it. And in Iceland in the 1970s, the women shut down the country in order for over abortion rights. And, you know, ultimately we are going to have to mobilize. We don't all agree. We're not going to all agree. We never will. We're as diverse as the nation, but there are some core issues that we need to stand up and fight for. And I think the more we recognize our own power to make change, the more that prophecy becomes fulfilled.
And that's it. We need to recognize we have the power to make change.
We do.
You know, it could be small, incremental, local level, which just expands.
It all matters.
It does. And that's one of the things that I'm glad you brought out, because it's so true. Lauren, where can people find out more about you and also All In Together?
Yeah, so they can go to aitogether.org, and we run programs all over the country, a really wonderful, uplifting, inclusive opportunities to come and learn. We have free babysitting. We do them on Saturday morning. So we want no barrier to women's participation in our programming. And they can also go to laurenleader.com, but come to aitogether.org, sign up for our mailing list, come to our programs. They're really positive. In a world of you know, negative stories, we really try to be a force for good.
That's great. And I want to thank you so much for joining me today. It's an important message. You know, women, we do have the power. We just need to find it within ourselves and use it. So, Lauren, I so want to thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Sylvia. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
Thank you for joining me today. If you liked what you heard, please share it with another person you think would be interested. And if you haven't already, please subscribe.
This has been a Life of Prey production.